basically that all three could coexist, friendship, love, whatever. And I think that the problem with the film is that it doesn't really stray very much from being a filmed play. I can imagine this thing put on the stage with about the same kind of verve that Mulligan gives to it. The other thing is the performance of the three people. The script is not a bad script. There are some funny lines, but these three people seem so awkward in their roles that they strain to try and make it a successful film, and the straining is really evident. Sally Field, I think, can be comic, often at times when she least wants to be. And I often enjoy her acting as a tortured woman. I found much of her performance in Norma Rae funny, and sometimes it was at moments when she was trying to be overly serious, to be the woman who had suffered a lot. She's, I think, cursed in a sense with a baby face that looks like it's been well-fed and well-cared for and really has not matured over the years. This is not in keeping with her personal life. I've seen, you know, interviews which attest to her having paid her dues and suffered enough and so forth. But I think that the film rises and falls, and in my opinion falls, on her performance, because she never quite makes us believe that, one, she really was enough in love with the dead husband, enough to mourn him. There's a lot of denial of the mourning that he really did die. And she's not enough of an actress to convince us that she is in love again to marry the Rupert, Jeff Bridges' character. I admire both Jeff Bridges and Jimmy Kahn as actors. Jeff Bridges was the main character in one of my favorite cult films, The Last American Hero, a Lamont Johnson film. And he's really straining a lot in this film to be the man in white shirt and tie, Egyptologist running the museum, a very respectable, a bit straight-laced curator of a museum who now is thrown into crazy company. When he least tries to act in this film, he comes off best. And he's trying, I think, overly hard to do his role, screams a lot, and doesn't come across as anything. James Caan, I think, is probably the success of the film because his role is the least. He is mostly a specter. He does a little bit of dancing and tapping with the cane and a lot of smiling and preening. And I think this is the most successful part of the film. What I was struck by, is my own reaction to such a film. And my refusal, I guess, as a addict film goer, to let the film just be a bad film. And I most of my friends who go to movies either decide this is a good movie or a bad movie. One of the things that I do as a constant film goer is to try and find a level at which I can appreciate a film, even knowing it's a bad film. And, you know, I'm not talking about bad taste movies. In this case, it's a very bland, banal movie. And I found myself enjoying it from the level of taking the stance of three pretty competent actors, Sally Field, Jimmy Kahn, Jeff Bridges, and trying to have empathy for them in roles that they may not have been very excited about playing.
Sounds like a pretty dismal level upon which to.
Well, actually, it was a lot of fun. I found myself seeing them quite humorously when the film wasn't trying to be humorous, straining to be the character and failing. I was constantly aware of their real life name. This is James Caan. This is not Jolly. This is Jeff Bridges and not Rupert. And in a sense, I got to enjoy the film that way as a failure.
The premise of it is really a genre, almost, with Topper and Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but does it compare?
I am, and, you know, I guess more familiar perhaps to some moviegoers would even be films with ghosts like Here Comes Mr. Jordan or Heaven Can Wait. And it doesn't stack up against any of those, where at some point in the fun, in the playing with the ghost, there's real human contact. There's real feeling about the passage of life. At some point, the spirit has to be missed or realize that he or she is gone. And there's no tragedy in Kiss Me Goodbye. There really hasn't been any death. And I think that the three characters weren't prepared to play it that way.
Okay, well, the film is Kiss Me Goodbye. What's on TV?
Well, an interesting motley collection, not a lot of good things. French Connection 2 is playing 3 in the afternoon on Channel 11. I've seen it enough times now that I actually like it better than French Connection 1. And the reason for that is the French sequences, how a genre film takes its detective out of American codes and conventions and throws him in as a stranger, as an alien in another culture. And so I appreciate it a lot. The Sergeant with Rod Steiger in the lead role, Channel 3 at 2 in the morning. This is already Sunday morning. On Sunday, Channel 11 at 8 p.m., The Little Foxes, Betty Davis and Herbert Marshall in the lead roles. The Pumpkin Eater is on again, Channel 9, 1 a.m. on Sunday night, Monday morning. On Monday, 12:30 p.m., so you can have lunch and watch this, Paths of Glory, Kirk Douglas in the lead role for Stanley Kubrick fans. An interesting collision of two talents, 8 p.m. Channel 17 on Monday, Strangers, the Story of a Mother and Daughter, Betty Davis and Jenna Rollins together. Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, Robert Donat in the lead role, Channel 11, 8 p.m. Mickey 1, one of my favorite What Does It All Mean pictures, Channel 9, and that's 9 p.m. on Monday night. That's Arthur Penn's film about a comedian who's chased by the mob, Warren Beatty in the lead role. On Tuesday, The Glass House, in my opinion, the best film made about prisons, Alan Alda and Vic Morrow in the lead roles, Channel 11, 8 p.m. Tuesday night. 12 midnight Tuesday, it's not a good film, and this is another example of appreciating a bad film. You can appreciate it for its humor, and it's not meant to be humorous. Rancho Notorious, Marlena Dietrich in the lead role, and this is the first film she made after leaving Von Sternberg. On Wednesday, Welcome to Hard Times, a very tough Western, Channel 17, Aldo Ray and Henry Fonda in the lead role. And I would encourage people to watch this one for what they feel like is missing from the traditional Westerns. It's a film stripped down, very austere, and not a very satisfying one because we're used to so much more in Westerns, so much cleaner town, more shootouts, and so on. Run of the Arrow, 12 midnight, Wednesday night, Channel 48, Rod Steiger in the lead role. And finally, on Friday night, Rollerball, Jimmy Caan, and this is a good role for James Caan, contrary to Kiss Me Goodbye, Channel 29, 8 p.m. Friday night.
Okay, well, have a good week, and
Thank you.
See you next Friday.
Thanks, Terry.
Bill Van Wert is Fresh Air's film critic, and he joins us every Friday on Fresh Air. It's 22 minutes to 4 o'clock, and this is 91FM, WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up today at about 4:25, we'll be featuring a documentary on Frank Rizzo, produced by WUHY's political reporter, Tia O'Brien. So that's coming up at 4:25. In just a moment, we'll be meeting Bob Muggy, who several years ago made a film about Frank Rizzo called Amateur Night at City Hall. We're going to discuss Bob Muggy's new film. It's called Black Wax, and it's a performance documentary about singer, songwriter, and poet Gil Scott-Heron. Before Muggy joins us, let's hear an excerpt of the soundtrack of the film.
We wrote a song for the new album that has raised a certain number of questions, particularly about the former mayor of Philadelphia, whose name was Frank Rizzo. The song that we wrote was called Gun. And it had a lot to do with Mayor Rizzo, rest in pieces. Say that because we're so glad he ain't the mayor no more. Frank Rizzo got on TV one time and said he was going to collect all the handguns. Personally, damn near. And that what he was going to do was he was going to put up these cardboard boxes at the fire stations. And when you was in the neighborhood and had a minute, you're supposed to come out there and drop your piece off in the box. So in the course of about 6 weeks, he had one gun that he had collected. And it was in bad need of repair. So they went down in South Philadelphia and they asked the brothers down there exactly what the situation was. Had they heard what the mayor said and this, that, and the other? And they said, yeah, they heard. And that as soon as the police turned their guns in, you should come back and ask them about it again. So we would like to do a song for you about the American streets. The song is called Gun. Brother man nowadays living in the ghetto, where the danger's soon enough for real. Well, if he's out late at night, if he's got his head on right, I lay you 95, he's walking with steel. Brother man said he's afraid of gangsters. See, messing with people just for fun. Yes, and he don't want to be next, he's got a family to protect. So just last week he bought himself a gun, and everybody got a pistol. Everybody got a 45. Yeah, but life seems to be at least as near as I can see. When the other folks give up theirs, I give up mine. This is a violent civilization. If civilization's where I am, 'cause every channel that I stop on got a different kind of cop on it, killing them by the main for Uncle Sam. But Saturday night just ain't that special. Yeah, got the Constitution on the run. Even though we've got the right to defend our home, defend our life, got to understand and get it in hand about the gun. 'Cause everybody got a pistol, huh? Everybody got a 45. Yeah, but lots of it seem to be at least as near as I can see. When the other folks give up or give up or give up, or I give up, or I give up, say. Freedom to be afraid is all you want. Yes, and you don't want to be next, might have a family to protect. 9 out of 10, you need a friend, you call a gun. And everybody got a pistol. Everybody got a 45, 38, 22, warning you. Philosophy seem to be at least as near as I can see. When other folks give up theirs, I give up mine. And everybody got a pistol. This must really be the NRA. Yeah, 'cause when it's time to sign up, you know damn well they're gonna line up. Everybody, everybody say that. What we talking about? Yeah, but life is seen to be at least as near as I can see. When other folks give up theirs, I give up mine.
As Gil Scott-Heron has recorded for Bob Muggy's new film, Black Wax, which opened Wednesday in New York. Bob Muggy, the producer, director, and editor of the film, is my guest. The central part of the film is a performance at a Washington club called the Wax Museum, which actually used to be a wax museum and still has some unconvincing-looking sculptures of such famous Americans as Ronald Reagan, John Wayne, Neil Armstrong, Martin Luther King, Duke Ellington, and Langston Hughes. Muggy has several cutaways in the film where Scott-Heron is commenting on the American scene to these wax figures. Muggy also weaves in footage of Gil Scott-Heron walking through official Washington, D.C., and through the black neighborhoods of D.C., ironically comparing the image of America, of the America the government presents, with the reality that black people live in. Heron in these sequences is carrying a portable radio cassette player and raps over the rhythm track of one of his records, which it is playing. Black Wax was commissioned by Channel 4, the new television station in England, which produced Nicholas Nickleby for TV, and this production was shown on American TV this week. Channel 4 learned about Muggy's work when they saw his film Sun Ra, A Joyful Noise, about the jazz composer and bandleader. They bought that film for broadcast. Muggy's other films include Amateur Night at City Hall, A Portrait of Frank Rizzo, and George Crumb, Voice of the Whale, which is about composer George Crumb. Bob Muggy currently lives in Delaware County. His new film, Black Wax, was reviewed this week in the New York Times, where Janet Maslin said it was adroitly directed. It will soon be the midnight show of a Washington, D.C. theater and will probably open in March at the International House in Philadelphia. Bob Muggy, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Nice to be back. Although you said everything I was going to say, I guess I might as well leave.
We can call it quits now.
Okay.
You want to give us the story of how the film was commissioned and came to be?
Well, as you said, I went over a year ago in November to the London Film Festival to show the Sun Ra film, and everybody there was talking about this Channel 4 entity at the time, which is their new, as you said, their new fourth TV network, their second commercial one, but one which is dedicated to serving minorities of all kinds, political minorities, cultural minorities, programming for artists, programming for women, programming for blacks, for programming for businessmen, programming for sports fans, just anyone that they feel is not properly served by the other three networks. As you've put your finger on a couple things right there that they've already done, like the Nicholas Nickleby, some recent, well, the film Moonlighting, which has been in town recently. I believe they put money into that, this film, doing a lot of things. So a lot of energy was happening at the time I was there, and everyone kept talking about this guy, Andy Park, who is the new commissioning editor for music, and I was making music films, so I should talk to him. And also I found out from my distributor in England at that time that he had just sold the Sun Ra film to Channel 4 and that Andy Park had liked it very much. So I got in touch with him, and I went in and talked to him, and we got along really well. Turned out to be bizarrely kindred spirits. Found out we had a lot of the same perverse musical tastes, that he has scores of Sun Ra records, scores of George Crumb records, and scores of Carla Bley records. And the reason I went in to see him was to try and get money for a film with Carla Bley that I'd been working on, trying to get funded for several years. The version of it at that time I'd been working on for a year with Francis Davis of the Fresh Air program. And unfortunately, Andy had just filmed Carla Bley at a festival there, but was still at that time interested because he didn't know how that film would turn out.
Well, how did you choose Gil Scott-Heron as a subject?
He put B-Movie on the turntable while we were there, turned it up full blast in his office, and said, "Listen to this." And I immediately knew it was Gil Scott-Heron. And I said, "Well, gee, Gil lives about 20 minutes from me, you know." And I was living back in Washington for a while at that time. And he said, "You know, somebody could make a film about Gil Scott-Heron, I'd fund the whole thing." So naturally, I rushed back to the States and started putting it together. And it took a while to get through to Gil because he does not have a phone or anything, and is the sort of artist that likes to be left alone most of the time. But once we did get together, he was very interested and very enthusiastic once we got shooting and all. And we just ended up getting it together and had a lot of fun making it.
Did he want to work on the format of the film with you?
Actually, no. In fact, that's kind of one good thing about the fact that he was so hard to get hold of a lot of time, is because it really didn't give him many opportunities to give feedback until we were actually doing it. But I think we were very much in tune, though. You know, I knew that my main job was to package Gil and his work, his personality, to get information about his past, about his concerns, to present his music, to present his poetry. And so I think he could tell from the beginning that everything I was trying to do was in the spirit of his work and was aimed toward that end. But once I would create overall structures for what we would do and give him some suggestions about what he could bring into that scene, like if I would give him these wax figures of people from American history, some of whom he had discussed in his poems or songs, and say, "Okay, we've built this set, we've got these wax figures here, here's some of the kinds of things that I think might work well," and then he'd take it from there, and we'd keep bouncing off of each other, you know, ideas. He turned out to be brilliantly spontaneous, would, you know, just immediately come up with something that worked wonderfully, you know, be it with wax figures of the past four U.S. presidents, or John Wayne, or his idol Langston Hughes, or, you know, Duke Ellington, as I think you mentioned, Benjamin Franklin, people like that. So we had quite a good time. But I would come up with a concept for him that, like, we're going to go through the streets of Washington and have you do your personalized tour of it. I mean, it's my city, too. I mean, I grew up in Washington, so I knew there were certain things to present just as he did. And so what we did was we presented, as you said, official Washington and then unofficial Washington, as he calls it and a lot of others do, Chocolate City. It's primarily a black city now other than the national government. And it's very exciting as a black city. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of energy there, I think. And then we took that into what I kept referring to as the ghosts of America's past. I said, I want you to visit the ghosts of America's past, and you've talked about them in your songs. Let's bring them into this. And so we created this set with the wax figures and acted as if he's like falling through the street or something and ends up there in a kind of Alice in Wonderland sort of thing. And he would just take the ball from there and did wonderful things.
When you were touring through the neighborhoods with him, there were people going about their business on the streets who weren't extras in your film or didn't think of themselves that way. What was it like going through the neighborhoods with Gil Scott-Heron? Did people recognize him and know him?
Yes, in his old neighborhoods where he used to have his office near Howard University. In one of the neighborhoods back there, a lot of people would recognize him, and everyone would recognize him at Howard because even if they hadn't known him from before, they were fans. But there would be a lot of other people on the street taking care of other kinds of business that we won't get into. But we had a lot of funny scenes. Like, for instance, Gil thought it was real funny to threaten to throw me out on particularly dangerous corners that he wouldn't walk on himself, and he would do that every so often. And there was one situation where we were followed by a van full of people who looked like they were right out of the Mod Squad. You know, there was a black guy with a clean-cut afro, and there was a white guy with the long hair, and there was a third guy in the back seat we really couldn't see. And these guys were obviously following us. And so we were communicating. I was in the car with Gil and his brother, and we had film crew in a van that would kind of follow us a block back, and we were communicating through walkie-talkies. And these guys just started following us, and so Gil would suddenly abruptly move to the curb and try to get them to pass us, and they'd pull behind us and all that. So this went on and on, and so finally we got where we were going, and we just stopped, and Gil walked up to their truck and said, you know, what the heck is going on? And because he thought they were, you know, going to try to bust us or something. It turned out they were a TV crew. They thought we were narcotics agents about to make a bust, and so they wanted to be the first reporters on the scene. So there were a lot of real crazy scenes like that. There was another. We had, when we shot in front of the White House, which we'd actually been refused permission for. In fact, the woman at the federal government that is in charge of such things, obviously a very loyal Reagan person, asked why we would want to film Gil Scott-Heron, whom she didn't know, of course, in front of the White House. She said, he just wants to be filmed there to promote himself. I said, well, why do you think Reagan has himself filmed in front of the White House to promote himself? She didn't think that was amusing. But we since we were using Steadicam, which, as many people know, is this device which makes for a very fluid handheld camera, but it meant we could be very flexible. We could move quickly onto a scene and out again. We did film a lot of stuff in front of the White House, and there were four Secret Service men standing around in their big brown shoes and suits trying to look like tourists, but it was so great because they'd do like football plays where if we were doing a tracking shot along in front of the White House, there'd be one at the start, there'd be another walking alongside, there'd be another that managed to be facing the fence a little farther up. And in the shots in front of the White House, you can see a couple of them. But Gil would make, there was this one that was real short, and Gil was making cracks about him as we'd finish the shot. And they were trying so hard to blend in. And there was another woman, moderately insane, semi-bag lady religious type who was trying to force us to take little religious things. And Gil, and she started making some kind of weird cracks, and Gil has a very confrontational personality, and he started giving her trouble back. And so she started saying that his people had been oppressing her for hundreds of years or something. It was, we had a lot of amusing scenes like that.
Any of that on film?
Not in the film. So, yeah, we have a number of things. In every film I've ever done, there have been things that, for various reasons, just can't quite quite going. I mean, if Dick Clark hosted a blooper series for films like this, it'd be a whole lot more interesting than Burt Reynolds flubbing his lines in Cannonball Run or something.
Bob Muggy is my guest, if you're just joining us, and we're talking about Black Wax, and that's his new film about Gil Scott-Heron that just opened in New York and will be probably coming to Philadelphia sometime in mid-March. Before we talk some more about Gil Scott-Heron and the movie, I thought we could listen to another excerpt. This is actually an excerpt of an outtake from the film that we thought you might like to hear. And just by way of setting it up, in his performances, Gil Scott-Heron does monologues as well as singing and doing some poetry. And he was doing a monologue about TV, talking about how what you see on TV shapes your vision of reality, and how he was really kind of appalled to find that since there were so many cop shows on TV, that a lot of his black friends were really identifying with the cops and not realizing, he said, that the cops were really chasing after their brothers. So this is the latter part of that rap.
The idea became so involved that if we didn't see it on television, regardless of what we saw in our own lives, we wouldn't believe it. And we was already the victims of an instant society. See, in America, you get everything instantly. You hit this and the lights come on. You pour the hot water in there. You got coffee or instant grits. Yeah, you got to be careful about them instant grits. They'll rock right up on you. But you know, instant hairspray for your natural and or supernatural, you got all that over here. So when people over here heard about revolution and they didn't see it instantly, they say, well, must not gonna have one. But the truth is, of course, that revolution is a gradual process. Process that starts with information. People who are not informed cannot be organized. People who are not organized cannot act effectively. And everybody will not gain the same consciousness or awareness on the same day at the same time. Fortunately, you do not need everybody to do something, because the nucleus moves the cell. You see, the nucleus decides it's going to be two cells. They don't take no vote. They split up. And both organisms is better off because that decision was made. If you're waiting for everybody, you will be waiting for quite a while. That's often an excuse people use for not doing nothing. They say, I'm waiting for everybody else. Well, hell, you ain't gonna have everybody else. So you're just in a permanent position of waiting. But we did a thing that we tried to do to point out the fact that, like, our struggle is local. Starts at the house first. Organize that. Then you try to organize the block. Then you try to organize the town or the neighborhood or the city. Because trying to organize the world in the beginning, you skip a whole lot of steps. Did a poem that says, you will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. Revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Wood and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict at 8:29, predict the winners on the reports from 32 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Glenn Campbell, Engelbert Humperdinck, or whoever and whenever they come up with them. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not be about a white lightning, white tornadoes, or white people. You will not have to worry about the dove in your bedroom, the giant in your toilet bowl, or the tiger in your tank. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, not be televised, not be televised, and be no rerun, brothers and sisters. Thank God the revolution will be live. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with some music. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
An excerpt of one of the outtakes of Bob Muggy's new film, Black Wax, a film about Gil Scott-Heron, who we just heard. And this film will probably be coming to Philadelphia sometime in mid-March. It will be a midnight show in Washington, D.C. It was commissioned by Channel 4, the new station in England, and opened this week in New York. And we'll be hearing another excerpt from the film in a little while. What do you think of his politics?
I wasn't expecting that question. I relate to a lot of his politics, really. I don't think I'd put anything in a film that I didn't agree with. But, I mean, I in none of his songs is he saying, go out and shoot the next person you see on the street, though I think at times he and the Last Poets and people like that often had that kind of image. They all got associated with, the H-Rap Browns and Stokely Carmichaels and all of the late 60s, mid-60s. I think in a way he's not much farther left than like a sort of a typical black liberal in a way. It's just he has a very strong way of saying certain things. Like, you know, who would be for apartheid in Johannesburg? Who would be for police brutality? You know, who would... Well, maybe I shouldn't ask that in this city, but considering the current faces back on the scene in electoral politics here. But I don't think I've heard him say anything which I did not agree with politically. I cringe at some of his puns sometimes, but politically I'd say we're pretty much the same corner.
When people write about issues or about their political views, and then you get close to them, you can sometimes compare what they say with the way they live. Did you find yourself doing that when you were working with him?
That's a very good point. In fact, I think the film does that to some extent too. I think when you see Gil Scott-Heron walking with his young daughter, laughing in front of the White House and stuff, when you see all the charm and intelligence that Janet Maslin referred to in her review in the New York Times, I think it's hard to find. To find Gil Scott-Heron's politics frightening, because I mean he does certain things for effect. Go ahead.
Oh, I guess I was asking too if you think he really lives his politics.
I think to a very, very great extent. In fact, I've been anguishing lately over this question of a film festival in South Africa, the Durban Film Festival, very much wants this film, and they sent me, and they knew that I had a real problem with it, partly on Gil's behalf, but partly on my own, of cooperating in any way culturally or economically or any other way with that country at this time. So they sent me information about the festival, a newspaper article that showed how they were taking the films from the festival into the black community, and how much it meant to the people in the black community, how they were getting films from black filmmakers in different parts of the world, including the recent film Killer of Sheep by a black American filmmaker. For the most part, the people who run this festival, their hearts do seem to be in the right place. But there are a couple of big questions. Number one, I think whatever Gil ends up saying about it, I think I personally would want to have it guaranteed that the film will be shown to black audiences as well as to white, and that it will be shown intact. And, you know, there is this song of his, Johannesburg, on there, as well as his poem, Black History. And both come down rather heavy on certain political forces in Africa, especially South Africa. And I've just told them that they can have the film as long as Gil does not veto it, because he still may have his own reasons. And I think we have to respect those because, I mean, he is someone who's committed his life to working towards certain ideals and all. But unless they can guarantee that the film will not be cut and that it will be shown to black audiences, which I don't think they can guarantee, I told them they can't have it. But no, I think he very much lives according to his ideals, and you know he as you know, was in the No Nukes movie and on the No Nukes record. He's very strongly against nuclear power. He was at a recent few months back. I guess it was last spring. He was at a big demonstration and kind of concert for peace in Los Angeles. He's always at Stevie Wonder's rallies for Martin Luther King in Washington for his birthday, which have taken place the last several years, but which is not taking place this week, I understand, because they're going to do something in August instead. But he's always where he feels he's needed to help the political causes he believes in.
a good deal of the film is concert footage. There's a lot of concert programs on TV, and there are certain, like, standard shots that have emerged from those programs. Are there things you wanted to do or wanted to avoid that you've seen done in concert movies?
Oh, very much so. I saw there being two opposite poles that I wanted to avoid. One is the sort of political film of the 60s, where every time a song comes on, you see cops beating people's heads in with shaky cameras, often black and white footage out of focus and all that. And, you know, very, very didactic as well as ragged. That was one thing I wanted to avoid. In fact, there were suggestions made to me at different points. He's singing about this. You're going to show people in the street. You're going to show this and that. So no, because that's what anybody would do. It's very boring to me to do what anybody would do. The other poll I wanted to avoid is the techniques of rock videos, which are becoming so prominent now. I'm living out in Delaware County as much as anything so that I could get cable, because I figure that in this country, that's really about the only viable market right now for what I'm doing. You know, films with a little bit of integrity, but deal with the arts, sometimes with politics. So I get MTV, and most of the stuff that is on there is absolute garbage. You know, where you take a song and you have them lip sync to it, and then you put some corny little student film like story to it. I wanted very much to avoid the gimmickry that goes with those. So I wanted a straightforward, dignified approach that would be appropriate for what he was saying, but also energetic, lively, keep an audience involved. And I was it was interesting, Janet Maslin talking about nothing running too long and all that in the film, because I was very conscious that I wanted to keep people entertained. I wanted to make a political film that was also an entertaining film. You know, there was this, I remember back in the days in film school, there was always this debate about what is a political film. Was a political film one that has a political message, or is it one which is structurally, stylistically appropriate according to certain Marxist film theorists or according to Jean-Luc Godard this week or whatever? Is it a film which meets certain criteria, or is it a film which communicates with people? And so I wanted to make, with this, as with other films I've made that have verged on politics, especially the Rizzo film, which Heidi Trombert and I made, I wanted to make a film which said what needed to be said, but didn't really preach to people in a very unpleasant way, which could involve them and entertain them at the same time. And I think we did it. We'll see.
When you're about to do a film, what parts are you most looking forward to, and which parts are you most dreading?
Okay, in answering that question, let me tie in something that I omitted from the last question. One thing I also wanted to do is make absolutely sure that there was no lip syncing. I hate that, as you could tell from my comments about MTV type stuff. Some of which is good. Occasionally, there's something real good on there. Usually by British people doing it. But I spend a lot of extra money on each of my films to make sure that we're getting live concert footage. And in fact, I won't even use 99% of the time, maybe once in a long time if I have absolutely no other choice, but I won't even use a cutaway of an audience member or something like that that wasn't shot at exactly the same time as what, I'm something of a purist about these things, sometimes to the point of the absurd, I suppose, but I mean, I believe if you're disciplined enough in making a film that you can plan for every contingency, you know, but not in the sloppy ways of, oh, just put a camera on it, we'll shoot a bunch of other stuff later that can be cut in to fake it, you know. But I don't believe in that. I believe in getting an event that happened, getting a situation that happened, and with a certain amount of concern for documentary ethics or something, though I try not to get stodgy about them. What do I most look forward to in films like this? Oh, just having fun. I mean, it's making movies. There's just nothing more fun. And I'm doing this because I really don't have as much fun doing almost anything else. And, you know, if I have to spend a couple years going through a lot of indignity and raising funds, a lot of pain and sacrifice and doing without certain things in order to have those few months of fun doing a film, it's worth it, you know, because of the incredible highs you get doing it. I mean, you know, there are no other times really when I am so totally involved, when like my creativity is totally harnessed, when I'm using as much of my brain as possible. You know, I can't be lazy. I have to work up to my own best standards, and so it's just incredibly satisfying. Although it's incredibly hard work when you're doing it. You know, all the cliches about perspiration and inspiration are true. You know, it's a lot of people watching filmmaking. This is a cliche by now, but you watch a film being made, it looks incredibly boring. But if you're involved, if your mind is the one that's selecting images, that's framing things, that's planning how things are going to cut, that's thinking how this piece of dialogue is going to cut with that one later, if you're thinking how we're going to possibly afford to shoot one more day if we don't get it, I mean, all these things at once, you know, the practical as well as the aesthetic, it's incredibly invigorating.
You've been at the openings for this film in New York and in London.
Right.
Where do you sit in the theater so as to best monitor the audience reaction?
Well, in London, my girlfriend and I sat in the seats to which we were assigned by the theater, which was funny because we ended up sitting right in front of people who made the other film that was showing with ours, and they were very rude. They kept talking through our film and through theirs, which damaged the experience a little bit. But we were sitting sort of toward the back. A number of friends and I, back in the early 70s, studied with a man who's now dead named Slavko Vorkopich, who is a film theorist as well as having made a lot of the montage sequences in famous old Hollywood films. And his theory was always that you should sit twice the length of the screen back. And that's what I usually try to do. His feeling was, and I would subscribe to it, as would my cameraman, Larry McConkey, his feeling is that unless you do that, you can't really see the film as it was meant to be shot. The lenses are set up so that the ideal distance is about two widths of the screen back. And you can only really see the cuts if you sit that far back. Also, if there's a good sound system in a theater, often it's the volume's up for someone fairly far back. If you want to be enveloped in a film like a dream, you want to sit close. You know, you don't care about seeing the cuts. But for a filmmaker, for film critics, you know, you want to see as much of what the filmmakers are doing as possible. And in New York, we actually sat about halfway back. It's a very small theater, the James Agee Room of the Bleecker Street Cinema in New York. But it was a lot of fun, and the crowd was quite enthusiastic. And I did sort of try to listen at the end of how much they enjoyed it. And a good time was had by all. Excuse me?
Did you pick up any interesting feedback?
Not really. Just that everybody was smiling, and that was enough in itself.
Do you know what your next project's going to be?
There are a couple. The one pretty definite one is a film with Al Green that Channel 4 apparently will be funding. The doggone British pound will just rise again so that they can get their dollars worth in trade. We're supposed to shoot that probably in April down in Memphis, where he now has a church. I suppose most people know that Al Green was pretty much the top American soul singer of the 70s, but more and more got involved in religion as he had as a very young person before. But so that he now has a church in Memphis, Tennessee, where he's a preacher and is a Grammy Award-winning gospel singer and doing very, very powerful gospel music, which with a lot of rock and blues influence and all.
Can you tell me briefly, when the person who works with you is the camera person is shooting, what are you doing and how do you know what they're getting and how can you direct them in real time as it's happening? How do you do that?
Yeah, that's always a problem, especially in this kind of filmmaking where you can't look through the lens every time to set up a shot and all. In fact, you know, because Larry McConkey owns a Steadicam and is a real expert in that, he's one of the top Steadicam operators now. We're constantly moving, but for instance, in the Wax Museum footage that we did, I'll tell you two things. I'll tell you about the concert, and I'll tell you about With the Wax Figures. With the Wax Figures, I would tell Gil a general kind of thing I'd like him to talk about. He'd, like, tell me some of what he thought, and then Larry and I would talk about patterns that we could film, like with Whitey on the Moon. I structured a very definite pattern with, you know, as with tracking shots, you know, with okay, Gil starts here next to Uncle Sam. Larry stays on this mark next to him. We see Douglas MacArthur and these others in the background. We continue on. Gil gets to a certain point. He stops. He continues on with the poem. He looks up, see Neil Armstrong floating from the ceiling in his spacesuit, goes back to Gil, see the American flag in the background. Finally, at the end of the poem, we go back up to Neil Armstrong. So it's very, very much choreographed. So I can pretty much guess what it's like, but also the Steadicam has a little video monitor, and every so often I can see into that. With the concert, we were using video monitors. Also, I was watching where people were, and we were communicating with headsets, so I would just tell people where I wanted to film, and if a camera ran out, I'd say, you got to go get that guy. All the things you see people doing in covering concerts, usually.
You've done films so far on George Crumb, a composer, Frank Rizzo, former mayor, now mayoral candidate, Sun Ra, a very crazy and very great jazz composer and band leader and pianist, and now Gil Scott-Heron. Do you see any connecting threads between the subjects that you've chosen in the movies?
But part of it is I always saw where my career was going to go as into trying to make independent features and doing music films on the side, because those were always my two interests. But all my attempts to raise money thus far for features for my own scripts have failed, and so I've continued making the music films, and I love them, but they're not all I want to do. But there are real obvious connections. Like, for instance, I have three Philadelphia films, Rizzo, George Crumb, Sun Ra. There are a lot of connections there. I have three music films, George Crumb, Sun Ra, Gil Scott-Heron. I'm about to have a third black music film. The Gil Scott-Heron film has a poem which ends exactly the same way as a poem ends in the Sun Ra film, totally by coincidence. As you heard earlier, Gil Scott-Heron talks about Rizzo, you know, and he does that without our really having talked about, well, he knew I'd made a film on Rizzo, but he talks about him anyway. But of course, I'm more inclined to use that because of the connection. Now, there are other really strong connections between the Rizzo film and this one, in that the Rizzo film was, the central theme of it was about a politician as showman, but about my vision of Rizzo is primarily of a person with great charisma who is very charming, but arguably not terribly competent. And I saw this connection with the amateur showman at the Triangle Tavern in South Philadelphia. Okay, so that was politician as showman. In the Gil Scott-Heron film, we have the reverse. We have the showman as politician. Not only Gil Scott-Heron as, you know, using entertainment as a medium for his political views, expressing his political views, but we also have the whole climax of the film, which I believe we're going to hear a little of shortly, which has to do with Ronald Reagan and a view of Ronald Reagan as a showman who became a politician because of what American people apparently wanted at a certain time.
And we will be hearing an excerpt of that in a moment. Let me just ask you, though, since Frank Rizzo announced that he would again be running for mayor, have you been getting a lot of requests for screenings or footage from your film Amateur Night at City Hall, which is about him?
Yes. Well, there's a possibility that Channel 4 in England is going to buy it. They had told me a while ago they very much liked the film and that if he ran again, that they'd very likely buy it. So I've just rushed off information about the fact that he's running. We were approached by some of Wilson Good's people who wanted to see it, just, I think mostly just to refresh their memory on Frank Rizzo's career. And as you yourself know, we were approached by ABC News Nightline earlier in the week, excuse me, and most of the, they did a thing with Rizzo Wednesday night, and most of the beginning of the show, the intro to the show, which had clips from his past, most of that was from our film. But I've discovered something very curious. You know, there's this, people are talking about the new Rizzo, and I was trying to figure out what that was, and I think I've got it, is that, as you know, many primitive societies believe that when you take someone's picture, you capture their soul. And when we were shooting shooting the film with Rizzo, I found that I was able to capture his soul, and I've been keeping it in a bottle in my house ever since. And I think what the new Rizzo actually is this new totally soulless politician. I mean, everyone said before that Rizzo had no soul, but now I can verify I've got it. Sunrise got mine, but I've got Rizzo's.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us. And I've been speaking with Robert Muggy, and his new film, Black Wax, opened this week in New York at the James Agee screening room of the Bleecker Street Cinema?
Right, in New York through Tuesday.
Okay, and in Washington, D.C., it will soon open as a midnight show in one of the theaters.
One of the Circle Theaters there.
It will be screened in Philadelphia probably in mid-March, and I will be able to announce that when it does open. And Bob's earlier films include Sun Ra, A Joyful Noise, about composer bandleader Sun Ra, Amateur Night at City Hall, about Frank Rizzo, and George Crumb, Voice of the Whale, about the Philadelphia-based composer. And good luck with Black Wax and all your future films, Bob.
Thank you.
And it was great to have you again on Fresh Air.
Great to be here.
We're going to hear now an excerpt of the part that Bob was just referring to, which is the prelude to B-Movie, which is his rap and record about Ronald Reagan. And before we hear it, I want to remind you that in just about 5 minutes, we'll be hearing a documentary produced by Tia O'Brien about Frank Rizzo. So this is Gil Scott-Heron, another excerpt from the film Black Wax, produced, directed, and edited by Bob Muggy.
We would like to do a tune for you. Actually, the tune was put together a little over a year ago. And the problem, well, there were several. But the main problem was what we was going to call the tune. And after we had put this tune together and looked at it, like, we decided we was going to call it Real to Real. This was going to be R-E-A-L to R-E-E-L. And that was certainly going to be the max. And then we said, no, might be some people that don't get it. So we decided we was going to call the tune From Real to Real to Surreal. And we was going to draw a lot of lines under Surreal so everybody would know that that was the main one. Then we said, no, that may not get it. Then we decided that we were going to call this particular idea From Shogun to Ray Gun. That covered everything that we wanted to talk about. Because, see, the news was loose about the mandate. A mandate would be indicating a majority, an overwhelming majority, as a matter of fact, a landslide. A majority of such force that it entitled the holder of this mandate to change everybody's life 180 degrees. So we went down in the community down on 7th Street, told some of the brothers there had been a mandate for Reagan. And he said, oh yeah? What was the final score? So they said, well, 26% of the registered voters voted for Reagan. And they said they would have been more impressed if it had been 26% of the American people. And then we said, well, Skippy come in second with 21% of the registered voters. And that among all the other people who was running also at the same time, they gathered about 2% altogether. First thing that the brothers noticed was that 51% of the registered voters had voted for nobody. And as far as they were concerned, that indicated that nobody should be the president. That 74% of the registered voters had not voted for Reagan, which indicated a mandate in the other direction. And after a few months of dealing with Reagan and his administration, they have come back to me and said, yeah, it's true. Nobody is the president.
Gil Scott-Heron, and that's an excerpt of the film Black Wax, a film produced, directed, and edited by Bob Muggy, who is based now in Delaware County. And again, that film will probably be coming to Philadelphia sometime in mid-March. It's now playing in New York and will soon be playing as a midnight show in the Washington, D.C. theater. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and you're listening to Fresh Air. WUHY's political reporter, Tia O'Brien, has produced a documentary on the career of Frank Rizzo, who announced earlier this week that he would run again for the position of mayor of Philadelphia.
Every neighborhood in this town would be destroyed if Bowser or Green were mayor. You think the Northeast would survive? You think Roxborough would survive?
What exactly?
You think South Philadelphia would survive? Kensington, Richmond.
I've had time to review some of my achievements and some of my failures or mistakes. So I think we'd say to Frank Rizzo, maybe he's just a little wiser, but can't change me.
Frank has an uphill road. I think he's gonna need a lot of money, because I think people's memories are long and they're fast.
I do not believe that that Mayor Rizzo can convince the black community that he has changed.
Even those that don't like Frank Rizzo, I think respect Frank Rizzo because of, if you look at what he's done with his life, it's quite an accomplishment.
This is Kensington, and anybody that knows Kensington, we want Rizzo. Hooray!
Frank Rizzo is gambling on 1983 to make his political comeback. The former police commissioner who became Philadelphia's most colorful and controversial mayor is a political legend. But even legends at some point in history can outlive their day. As he enters the Democratic primary, Rizzo is bracing for the toughest election ever, a head-on fight with former managing director Wilson Good. If he wins that, more candidates are waiting to take him on in the fall. In a city where blacks make up 44% of the Democratic registration, Rizzo's got his work cut out. In order to win, he's hired high-priced media consultants. They're devising a strategy to project the best of Frank Rizzo, his accomplishments while mayor, and with a mellowed Rizzo on the campaign trail, they hope to minimize his negatives, a deserved or undeserved reputation as a mayor who racially polarized the city. I'm Tia O'Brien, and in the next half hour, we pose the question, can Frank Rizzo make a political comeback? It's a question we can't answer, but we'll look at many of the factors which will influence the outcome. Let's start by picking up the Rizzo story in 1978, the year Rizzo mounted his last political battle, his fight to change the city charter so he could serve a third term. It's a fight that still is ringing in the ears of many.
We have reached in our society where we're all not created equal anymore.
I know that.
Certain groups want special privileges, and we just can't let that happen.
March 15, 1978. In the crowded basement of a Whitman Park Catholic school, over 1,000 residents turned out to fight a U.S. Supreme Court